dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're doing some intelligence collection here at the Conservative Political Action Conference. As this program airs, it will be last week's conference. As we tape it, it is underway, though, and I couldn't be more pleased that we're kicking things off with a friend and colleague who brings considerable intelligence, both of the old-fashioned kind, as well as the human kind, to the topics that we're anxious to talk with him about. His name is Brad Johnson. He formerly served in very senior positions in the United States Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine services. These days, he is the president of Americans for Intelligence Reform, and a great resource to those of us who are anxious about what's happening, well, both inside and to, and notwithstanding our Central Intelligence Agency and other intelligence services. Brad Johnson, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm so appreciative to you for your service to our country over many years and that which you are continuing to render now at Americans for Intelligence Reform. Welcome back. Let me ask you about the state of U.S. intelligence. We have certainly seen more evidence of, well, the politicization of it, I guess is the genteel way to put it, that has been taking place since Donald Trump turned up. We've heard, of course, from Chuck Schumer, among others, that you don't want to mess with the intelligence community because they will get you. And there's certainly evidence that that has happened. Tell us what you make of what's happening to your old community and the implications for the rest of us.
Yeah, I think that's a very apt description of what's been going on since President Trump walked down the elevator and announced his candidacy and everyone assumed that it was nonsense and he had no chance. He's been under attack by both the press, but also, and here's the dangerous part, it's also been a very heavily politicized intelligence community, and at the forefront of that has been the FBI and CIA, which are obviously both card-carrying members of the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. So that is a very, very dangerous precedent.
At the leadership level.
No question.
In both of those agencies.
Yes.
John Brennan at the Central Intelligence Agency, notably, Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe, notably in the FBI. Some in, I guess, their lower tiers, but primarily right at the top of these two agencies. And what does it mean when people with the kind of power that they have turn it against, first a candidate for office in our country, and subsequently for the commander-in-chief?
Well, what that means is that the FISA court is subject to their use and whims, and that's precisely what we saw happen. They got the original FISA warrant approved with three extensions, and those were 100% political documents. It's well documented, and McCabe is actually going through some legal problems right now over the fact that he signed off on this document, the FISA warrant, which he knew to be based on a document that was complete nonsense.
So the so-called dossier.
That's correct, the Steele dossier that everyone's been talking about for so long. So that is 100% confirmation of the weaponization of the intelligence community, the IC, used specifically against a political opponent.
And the judiciary as well.
That's absolutely right.
FISA court.
Yeah, absolutely right. And we've seen there's a long history of problems with the judicial activist judges that we've seen out there. And this is the result. This is why that's a problem. And those people in the long run aren't responsible enough to hold those positions. And this is an example of why.
We have, as a result of all of this, a constitutional crisis, a real mortal threat to our country. One of the things that has been hoped for as a corrective is that these individuals responsible for subverting, trying to destroy, using their powers as federal officers against the serving president, the duly elected president of the United States, would rest with a prosecution investigation now, possible prosecution being conducted by the U.S. Attorney in Connecticut, John Durham. What can you tell us about the Durham investigation? Is it likely that at the end of the day, he will do what Michael Horowitz and what the various other authorities who've been asked to look into one past aspect of this or another have been unwilling to do, namely to actually hold these individuals to account. And will they have the evidence to do so?
Oh, yeah. I think the evidence is just overwhelming. It's even reaching the public level, where I'm seeing a lot of things that have come out in the public that are overwhelmingly conclusive. Now, I have the advantage of having come out of that background, so I understand what I'm seeing, which the general public doesn't have that advantage. And also, of course, the mainstream media doesn't like to report it with that, you know, the factual basis there that's underneath it all. So now the Durham report is going to be highly detailed. This has gone around the hill. Everybody knows that he's writing this and dotting every I and crossing every T, and it's going to be highly detailed. And what everybody is saying is that there's certainly going to be a number of high-level indictments come out of this thing. So we're expecting to see a fairly good-sized number of indictments out of this Durham process. And he's got the authorities that some of the Horowitz and some of the others previously did not have. So he's in a better position to go forward.
In terms of subpoenaing and
correct,
getting people outside of the Justice Department and so on.
Correct. Right? Exactly right.
And this is heartening, needless to say, if true. We've been promised similar kinds of breakthroughs in the past. I have the feeling that this one may be different, in part because it seems to me as though John Durham is not only, by all accounts, a man who is going to get the facts no matter where they lead and will act on those facts, as he has done against the FBI in cases of corruption and the like in the past, but also because he's got top cover. He's got an attorney general who I have to tell you, Brad Johnson, I was not all that confident was going to be up to the job, and have been enormously impressed, including, I have to say, we sponsored, under one of my other hats, the Save the Persecuted Christians, sponsored the Attorney General's remarks at the National Religious Broadcasters just this week. And it was a fabulous speech. And he's made a number of them. And it's not just that he's rhetorically gifted or he's making important remarks. It's that I think he believes what he's saying about really the perilous state of our republic and the need for us to pull together, including to restore the rule of law in a way that I have the feeling is going to ensure that John Durham does deliver the goods here. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And God bless that effort on his part. And I really hope he succeeds wildly. We need to see the politicization of the intelligence community has to be eliminated. It's just too important to national security. And it has to be eliminated. And those, if they are indeed guilty of all these things that we've discussed, they have to pay maximum penalty for these sorts of things. And everything should be on the table so that they pay the price for it. Because we have to make it clear that this cannot be tolerated in the future. And if you have a political axe to grind, you better keep it to yourself.
Very quickly, we're almost out of time. Does that mean that Gina Haspel, the director of Central Intelligence Agency, who seemingly was intimately involved in some of these shenanigans under John Brennan, must be held to account as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The former DNI, FBI, current director of the CIA, everyone who's involved needs to be held accountable. A lot of information indicating that she was involved. There's also rumors out there, people that have confirmed, supposedly, that Gina Haspel, the current director of the CIA, is also lawyered up. So that means she's aware she's being looked at. So, yeah, I mean, there's a reason for that.
Stay tuned, folks. More with Brad Johnson will be forthcoming, I know, from Americans for Intelligence Reform. Again, thank you. You served as a chief of station in a lot of awful places, among other roles you performed. Your service continues. We're deeply grateful for it. Come back to us again soon with updates. Next up, we will speak with Paolo Borchia from the European Parliament, one of the other distinguished visitors that we've connected with here at CPAC. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and continuing conversations that we have recorded in advance at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland at Washington's National Harbor. We're speaking with an assortment of very interesting people we have found here at CPAC, some of them known, some of them new friends, some of them American icons, some of them leaders, up-and-coming leaders in particular, in the conservative movement in other countries. And I'm very pleased to have just met Paolo Borchia. He is a member of the European Parliament. He represents the Lega Party of Italy in the Parliament. We're not holding it against him, but for some 9 years before he was elected as a member of the European Parliament. He worked there, but I'm assured that he was recognizing he was deep behind enemy lines as he did so. So we're going to take this as a starting point for a new friendship, and we're very appreciative of your time, sir. Thank you for being here and for sharing this with us a bit about what is happening. Let's start with in your own native Italy, and then we'll talk about what's going on in Brussels as well.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. Thank you very much for your very nice invitation, first of all. I'm very glad to have the opportunity to introduce my party, our political action, the message of our leader, Mr. Matteo Salvini, and to explain what's going on in Italy and in Europe. For the moment, it's not very easy to explain what's happening in member states of the European Union without talking about EU, because actually more or less 80% of national legislation is decided by Brussels. And
which was one of the irritants that prompted the British to leave the European Union.
Yes, for sure. And if we want to talk about Brexit, I think that I have a personal interpretation, because now, to be very honest, many Eurocrats, many bureaucrats are very scared, because they are afraid that the UK will face a better situation after Brexit. And I think that Brexit could be and should be an opportunity for Remainers. But if we want that Brexit is an opportunity, we should be smart, intelligent, and try to look at the past and try to have an assessment on what went wrong with European legislation. To be honest, I don't want to be too optimistic, because in Brussels there is only one way, and if you propose some alternatives, you're not very appreciated. And it's happening with my party, Lega, and with my political group, Identity and Democracy, because mainstream parties put a cordon sanitaire in order to avoid that we participate in a more active way to the daily political life. And
inside the European Parliament, you're talking
about? Inside the European Parliament, and I think this is a very weird and dangerous message to electors, because electors sent on past May a precise message to Brussels. They are quite fed up, they would like to have an alternative, they would like to reform the European Union, but I'm afraid that that the mainstream parties weren't able and didn't want to understand that times are changing. There are new forces that should be listened in order to avoid collapse and in order to improve daily life of people and enterprises. And then,
when you say collapse, what do you mean by collapse? Talking about the European Union's collapse, or are you talking about the economies of the European Union collapsing?
I'm talking about a model that we thought that it was perfect for many years, and now after many years after the Second World War, some Eurocrats have the only motivation that EU helped us to avoid several wars, but it's not enough. Times are changing, and we should be able to propose something new and something reliable for our citizens.
Let me ask you about what is happening in Italy itself. I know there have been lots of turmoil in the European political arena generally, but Italy seems, as usual, to be particularly animated, shall we say, by political strife. What is the story with respect to the Lega party right now and its prospects internally to Italy?
Currently, Lega is the oldest party in national parliament, as it was established in 1989 from the fusion of different regional leagues. And the goal was and is a federal reform of the state. The new element is that until a few years ago, Lega was present only in northern Italy regions, but now, after Matteo Salvini became federal secretary, it means present of the party, the party leader. He tried with success to give this message to center and southern Italy regions. And so now, according to polls, we are around 32%, and we are the first party.
These are according to political opinion polls at the moment?
Yes, but in Italy we have one poll each week, so it's an attitude.
A lot of evidence.
In my country, And in 2018 we had the national elections, and due to our particular electoral law, the scenario was quite fragmented, and the only possibility was a government between left-wing populist party, five-star movement, and us.
And just to calibrate, you're a conservative party, is that fair to say?
Yes.
And you had your roots in the northern part of Italy, but what you're saying is that the conservative message is now resonating with people throughout the country, and you've dropped the Northern League name in favor of just the League, is that right?
Yes, yes. Let's call it a national transition. And, we had 1 year experience with Five Star Movement. It was not positive for them because they lost half of their votes, while we were able to double. So it means that electors thought that the political action of government was positive on Lega side. And then after 1 year, we needed to break up this experience because we weren't able to get the results we promised to our electors. I mean, federal reform of the state, development of infrastructure, and the introduction of a flat tax. Because our method is trying to reduce taxes with federal reforms able to help the country to be much more efficient, and in order to allow to the most developed regions to drive the country. This solution was not possible, and so now we have a different kind of government with Five Stars Movement and the Democratic Party. And so it's a left-wing government, very unpopular in the country.
So the League is out of government at the moment?
The League is out of government starting from last summer, because I fully agree with Matteo Salvini's decision, because in my opinion, the main and the high goal of politics is not to be in government, but to be able to keep promises that we made to our electors. And so it means that if you're not in the condition to do it, it's better to give up and wait for new elections.
Let me talk to you. Yeah. Two things that are very much on my mind, and I think probably a lot of Americans at the moment about Italy. One, you are wrestling with an outbreak of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
That is having implications, obviously, for Italy itself, but also now for the continent and places one travels to from Italy and so on. And the second thing is, more generally, what Italy is doing with respect to China. It's bad enough that you've got their virus, but they are, as I understand it now, increasingly inside some of your infrastructure. Is that a policy that the League supports, or do you find that troublesome?
From concerning China issue, in general, we have many enterprises working with China. They think that China is an opportunity, but I think that we should always keep open eyes, notably on 5G issue, because in general people are a little bit concerned in Italy about this this context from healthcare point of view, but on the other point of view, because they don't know how China will deal with big data, with all sensitive information. And so, in my opinion, at European level, we should be able to find an alternative and maybe to build a European way for managing big data without being dependent on China. We are called sovereignist, we are called populist, but when I come back to Italy during the weekend, I must give very concrete solutions to my elector. That's why I don't think that
concerning big data management, concerning high capacity computers, very complicated issues. We should try to unite European forces on other fields. Maybe it's better if every single state tries to find solutions. But I think that for big data, a European way is positive. On coronavirus, currently Italy is the third country in the world for a number of cases. People are very concerned. This should be the last week where public places are closed. And to be honest, I'm very sorry for all victims, but all victims had some previous pathologies. They were quite old aged, and so they were in a complicated situation from a clinical point of view. I think that the most important thing is trying to keep on making controls and trying to avoid to spread panic among people.
Thank you very much, Paolo Borcia, Member of Parliament in the European Parliament. We're very appreciative of you taking the time to visit with us and to, I hope, begin a relationship that will enable us to keep track of what's going on both in Italy, your native land, as well as in Brussels. Next up, we will speak with Carolyn Glick, Senior Fellow of the Center for Security Policy and one of the smartest people on the planet, about the Middle East and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are continuing conversations that we recorded last week at the Conservative Political Action Conference, a gathering of great Americans and a few great former Americans, and a woman who I have come to admire as well as cherish, both as a friend and as a colleague, as a great freedom fighter on both sides of the pond, is with me here at CPAC. Her name is Carolyn Glick. She is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, something I'm extraordinarily proud of. She is a brilliant writer, among other things, of The Israeli Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East. Also, Shackled Warrior. Carolyn's books can be found, as can her great writings, at carolynglick.com, and we like to post as many of them as we can, as well at the Center for Security Policy site, securefreedom.org. Carolyn Glick, as we are speaking, you are obviously here in Washington, but you will be heading home shortly, and indeed when this program airs, you will be there, please God, about to vote in your most recent of what seems to be an endless series of parliamentary elections. Before we talk about that, I wanted to talk about the subject of your most recent column, which talks about our election here in the United States and the appearance, at least to this point, we don't know what will happen in South Carolina or in Super Tuesday, but certainly so far, Bernie Sanders seems to be increasingly the darling of the Democratic Party's base. What does that mean, as you see it, for the United States, but also for your country, Israel?
Well, thanks. It's great to be here with you, Frank. Usually when we do these interviews, it's on the phone from a distance of 6,000 miles, so it's kind of a new experience to be doing it while I'm sitting across the table from you, so it's
a
real pleasure.
Considerable improvement. I hope you'll make this a regular
practice.
Yeah,
You know, what we're seeing now with Sanders' rise, and right now, I mean, certainly it's early in the race, but still, it appears that he's the presumptive nominee because he has the largest captive vote in the Democratic primaries. I don't know if it's a quarter of the registered Democrats or somewhere in that neighborhood, and you can win the nomination with that. And it seems to be that he's been running for 5 years continuously, and it's making a difference. And one of the things that we've seen, really, and we saw it very clearly in the last debate, is that there really isn't a lot of dispute about his positions. When he says things, people may differ on their views of his electability. That's one of the things that they were attacking him for. But nobody has actually been disputing the major foundations of what he thinks and what he's been saying. And this is a very disturbing situation because what it really means is what we've been warning about for years when we're looking at what happened to the British Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn since 2015. that that was the direction that the Democrats were going. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama launched the fundamental transformation, if not of America, then certainly of the Democratic Party back in 2008. And what we're seeing now with the rise of Sanders and the absence of dispute over his radical policies, his anti-American policies, his anti-capitalist policies, his anti-Semitic policies, is that there has been a full-scale Corbynization already of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders said several times over the past many years that his vision of the Democratic Party is for it to be the American version of Jeremy Corbyn's Labor Party. And from a specifically Jewish perspective, that means that the Democratic Party has become an anti-Semitic party. It does support terrorists, Hezbollah, Hamas, and all the rest of them against Israel, which is why you saw also a lot of condemnation of Donald Trump's order to kill terror master Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guards of Iran. This is a very disturbing state of affairs, and this is the reality.
It is the reality, and I fear that even if it doesn't succeed this time around, what Bernie Sanders has tapped into, and that core of his base of support, I think you'd agree, Carolyn Glick, is the younger cohort and their determination, it seems, to embrace these kinds of policies, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn's policy, which is not so well known here, or more to the point, it's carbon copy in Bernie Sanders, is that eventually this will be the policy of the Democratic Party's nominee and perhaps at some point its president as well, which is terrifying on a whole host of reasons. No, not least, let's talk about what it might mean for Israel to have such an individual, such a policy sort of predilection in the White House.
Well, first, I think we have to think about it just from the terms of the Democratic Party, because the likeliest scenario that we're looking at right now is that he does become the nominee for president. And given the likelihood that that will happen, and if he doesn't become the nominee, by the way, it's not necessarily going to make a difference, because whoever then does become the nominee is going to have to bow to Sanders and his camp to convince his supporters to vote in November against Trump, so that his bargaining position inside of the party is going to be so powerful that the ultimate effect will be that there's not that much distinction between another outcome and the outcome that we're predicting now, which is that he will win the nomination. And so that implication is that the second party in the United States, people always talk about there being a partisan divide over Israel. That's been going on for many years. I was reading a book that was written 15 years ago, and they were talking about a huge disparity in support for Israel already back in 1984. So we're not talking about something new, but it's not just a disparity. It's that you see today there's only one Democratic candidate for president, Michael Bloomberg, who hasn't, by the way, run in any of the primaries that we've had to date. He's the only one who's going to the AIPAC policy conference. And, you know, I mean, it's a liberal, moderate liberal group. They're by no means right wing. And, you know, they don't have discussions like the one that we're going to be having today at CPAC about Israeli sovereignty over Judea and Samaria at what's supposed to be the most pro-Israel group in Washington, but actually that's CPAC. And again, we're talking about the disparity in the positions of the two parties. But the only Democratic presidential candidate that would go to even that moderate liberal conference of AIPAC is Michael Bloomberg. All of the other candidates said that they were going to boycott it. And Sanders slandered AIPAC and called it racist. So because he has embraced this anti-Semitic ideal that the Jewish National Liberation Movement and the Jewish state are racist, that we don't have a right to exist.
Carolyn, let me just ask you about this, because this is, you talk about the fundamental transformation of the
right.
party. This is one of the clearest mm-hmm. proofs of how far this is
yes.
actually metastasized now. AIPAC used to be a place that Democratic politicians, and not unfrequently Republican politicians for that matter, felt the need to go and be seen and be supported.
Right.
To find this conclave now essentially verboten to Democratic candidates speaks volumes, as you say, not only about the influence of Bernie Sanders himself, but the radicalization of the party as a whole. So where does this leave Israel in the end? You're about to have an election of your own.
A third in less than a year.
In less than a year. It seems as though it may well wind up with the same kind of
inconclusive result.
If things are this sporty with respect to the United States, how important is it that Israel embrace a leader and get on with the business of standing up, you know, for itself in this relationship with us?
It's critical. It's critical because one of the things that I wrote about in my article that came out today is that, we have an ongoing war with the Hamas regime in Gaza. That's not going to end anytime soon, because as long as that regime exists, it's going to be at war with Israel. And there's no successor, even theoretical one, that exists or that may exist in our lifetimes that is going to be willing to live at peace with Israel. So the left has embraced Hamas and the Palestinians as their sweetheart, as their cause célèbre, like the Sandinistas in the 1980s, like the Viet Cong in the 1960s. And so if we already faced this in 2014 in the Gaza war in 2014 when Obama and his administration sided with Hamas against Israel and tried to coerce Israel into bowing to Hamas's ceasefire demands. Prime Minister Netanyahu was able to avert that by making an alliance with the Egyptians, the Saudis, and the UAE against the United States, Qatar, and Turkey and Hamas. And it was going to be too embarrassing for Obama to stand not only against Israel, but to stand against Egypt in particular. And so he stood down, and Israel was able to fight until Hamas accepted its ceasefire demands. The problem here is that the Democratic Party today doesn't have that kind of shame. Just like Netanyahu did not want the Israeli public to know how hostile the Obama administration was towards Israel. In fact, Obama didn't want the American public to know how hostile he was to Israel because he didn't want to get pushback from his fellow Democrats. Now you see, through AIPAC, the marginalization of the American Jewish community in left-wing politics. Nobody cares about them anymore. And therefore, the next Democratic president, whomever it is, whenever it comes out, unless something fundamentally changes back in the Democratic Party, they're going to be happy to be openly hostile to Israel and openly...
And seen as such,
yeah. Exactly.
Carolyn Glick, we have to leave it at that. Mm-hmm. I pray that there will be a sensible outcome in your elections.
Thank you.
As well as in ours, needless to say. Thank you for making the visit here to Washington to speak both to CPAC and, more importantly, of course, to us here at Secure Freedom
Radio. Absolutely. Always most important to be with your friends.
It is indeed. God bless you, my friend. And safe home.
Thanks.
And good luck with the election.
Thank you very much.
We'll speak with somebody else right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversations with interesting folks that we have met along the trail here at the Conservative Political Action Conference in the National Harbor. We've found one of them to be a gentleman by the name of Nan Su, who is a senior reporter with a terrific publication, Epoch Times. It is a project, I believe, of the Falun Gong movement, but it does outstanding work covering not just what's happening inside of China and Asia more generally, but frankly, some very good reporting about what's happening here in the United States and elsewhere as well. Nan Su is originally from communist China. He got out of there shortly before the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. And he's been a journalist for some 16 years, including some time in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he was a talk show host. He is now a senior reporter, as I said, for Epoch Times, covering China, Taiwan, and California. It's interesting that you've clustered those three entities together. We're wondering about the communist state of California some days. Interestingly, I'm headed there as this program airs. I'll be in California to talk about the problem that we see with particularly the state pension fund of California. Now, under the administration of its chief investment officer, whom, as I assume you know, Yu Ben Meng, is massively investing in companies in communist China that are very problematic. Mm-hmm. Some of them are doing, in fact, very dangerous things from our point of view, and I think dangerous to the people of China. Is this something that you have been taking a look at, by any chance, Nan?
I was actually the first.
Critical issue.
I wrote the very first report on that.
You did?
Yes.
Super.
And it was published in July of last year.
On this chap Meng, or on more generally on the problem?
Yeah.
What do you know about him, and what makes him tick?
Well, what makes him particular interesting to us when I started investigation is I first found that he was a Thousand Talents Plan practitioner. And that plan has been used by Chinese government to do the espionage through that plan and then to recruit the talents that's been making major contributions in the United States and the Western world. So what they're trying to do is that
when you say contributions, we've been making contributions of technology and
who knows
what all else to communist China from the United States.
Well,
this is why I guess
first of all,
FBI is calling it an espionage operation.
That's right. Well, first of all, the FBI report says it may not be illegal if you join the participate that plan. But however, the participants of the plan can be easily converted to a spy or someone to steal the patent from the United States. So what happens is what they're trying to do is, for example, if one scientist, he has a research lab in Harvard.
Say the chairman of the chemistry department, for example, at Harvard.
Right. Well, usually they will target not this administrative staff, usually the ones that's really pioneering all these research labs,
but
right?
But the guy who's administering them has access to all of their information, presumably, and is in a position to pass it along, don't you?
Well, that's not how it works, though. How it works is they are trying to target the cutting front, the cutting-edge technology. Say you are a scientist, you are leading a research project, you have a lab in Harvard, right? So what they're going to do, and you are Chinese, you came to United States to study, you graduate, you establish yourself. So what they're trying to do is they will come to recruit this person, and then what they do is they will establish your same lab, same equipment and staff in China. So whatever your research here in Harvard will automatically be copied and transferred in China.
Well, it's interesting you say this. I mean, look, this fellow who's the chairman of the Harvard chemistry department has been arrested for his work. And the fact that he was also doing work for the Defense Department of the United States and didn't let the DOD know that he was working for China.
That's right.
This is problematic. But back to Meng. He sort of makes it sound like this is no particular big deal. He went back as part of this Thousand Talent program, as I understand it, to China.
That's right.
To manage its foreign exchange reserves.
That's right. He's a chief investment officer, deputy chief investment officer for China's foreign, manages China's foreign reserve.
Right. So that's a big job.
It is.
And he spoke to the People's Daily, as I recall, while he was there, saying that he considered it the honor of a lifetime to work for the motherland.
That's correct.
Now he's back.
And
CalPERS
hired him back.
The several hundred billion dollars of funds under management for the California Public Employment Retirement System, CalPERS, is going. And it turns out a lot more of it is going into Chinese companies than was the case before he came back.
That's correct. He
so what's up there? I mean, does this trouble you as a journalist, as an investigative journalist? Does this, on the face of it, smack of a recruitment that has continuing dividends for the Chinese Thousand Talents program and the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, it's interesting that the Thousand Talents plan is not only limited to hiring the scientists or engineering, but they also hire the financial managers, top financial managers here in the United States as well as in the Western world.
Right.
And now, however, there's a difference. If you're a scientist, your project, it's like they want to directly copy those projects. But you can't hold both. Usually they encourage the scientists in this plan to work simultaneously, like 6 months in the US, 6 months in the China, mm-hmm. that kind of a setup. But you can't do this for a manager in financial district, apparently, right? So it's among a part of that program that's commit something. We don't know. We don't have that fact. Right now, we don't have the evidence.
We're seeing is he's making investments in indexes in most cases, but also actively traded companies, as I understand it, mm-hmm. with China.
That's correct.
And some of those companies are doing things like building weapon systems with which to attack this country.
Absolutely.
And oppress the people of China.
Yes.
And build fortified islands in the South China Sea. And I mean, on and on and on. All of which... not only enriches, but enables the Chinese Communist Party to be an even bigger threat to us.
Yes. Well, he has direct helpers invest in a lot of China's space program. That's all the PLA program.
Right.
That's China's military.
Yep.
And China's
and Huawei and
shipbuilding
and
companies that's building the aircraft carrier.
Right.
And then China's communication and then some of the companies are building the internet for North Korea. Mm-hmm. And he has been directing CalPERS doing all those investments. So that's what we know. Now, if he actually commit any crime, I think that will be the call from FBI.
Of course. Let me ask you about one other thing before we run out of time. Again, we're speaking with Nan Su, the senior reporter at Epoch Times. Your beat covers Taiwan.
Yes.
As well as the mainland. I'm very apprehensive, especially as the Chinese are now beginning to crack down, somewhat under the radar, but nonetheless crack down in Hong Kong, that they may, when the weather improves, see the coronavirus distraction and the election and all the other things that are going on elsewhere around the world as the opportunity finally to invade Taiwan.
Well,
what are your thoughts on that?
I think if Beijing decides to invade Taiwan, that means basically internally the society is out of their control. Mm. Only to that point they will make that decision, because that's going to be a huge negative against the communist regime. It's going to be worldwide. If they invade Taiwan, they will turn the entire Western world against the Chinese communist regime.
I would like to think so, but you know how these guys are. Nothing's more important than the survival of the party. If they could construe this, man, as a call to patriotism, rally around the
flag, boys,
prop up the support for the party that has discredited itself by the coronavirus and more, it could be the last resort of these tyrants. So what do you think the prospects are of that? The conventional wisdom says that it's too risky and they'd rather take over Taiwan without firing a shot if they can. I'm just wondering whether things are getting to a pass where that may not likely be the option.
I think the United States is making the full engagement right now. Already we are sending the warships to Taiwan Strait and we are building Guam. And we are in very closely watching what's going on the two sides of Taiwan Strait. I think
and enhancing deterrence is what
you're
saying.
Right.
Good.
I think that the Chinese regime doesn't stand a chance.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Nan Su, thank you. And the outreach that you all are making to not only God's ears, but to an awful lot of Americans is very, very valued. So thank you. I know you'll keep it up.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.